talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer again with you.
Good morning. Today is July 5th, and I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Batts.
Kate Marquis.
And this is the We Are Movie Geeks podcast. Kate Marquis is filling in for Michelle today because Michelle is still wherever Michelle is. But she'll be calling in a few minutes to talk about the top 10 Kate Reviews movies for the Jewish Light and WeAreMovieGeeks.com. So Kate keeps pretty busy. How you doing, Kate?
I'm doing fine. How are you, Tom?
Very good, thank you. What's your favorite movie so far of 2016?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah,
I'm going to put you on the spot here.
Yeah. I hadn't really thought about that, but I'm going to say just on impulse, and I'll probably change my mind tomorrow, I'm going to say The Lobster.
The Lobster.
Which was a very crazy, very strange
movie. It is. It's
movie.
Wonderful.
Yes.
Right.
Okay.
Well, if you change your mind in the next hour, feel free to let us know.
Yes, okay. If you come up with another one there. Oh, The Forest. Yeah, that's right.
No.
That's not going to be anyone's best list. No.
Well, let's give Michelle McHugh a call because we've got a lot of movies to review. We've got 8 movies to review, and we've got to talk about the top 10. We've got a couple of obits to talk about and birthdays and stuff like that, so it's a busy show. So let's give Michelle a call. And here she is. We have Michelle McHugh on the phone. Hello, Michelle.
Hi there, Tom. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Michelle.
Hello.
How are things in hot, balmy Texas?
Yes, they are. That's exactly right. They're hot and balmy, but it was a great 4th of July weekend here and at the box office.
Okay. Well, that's why we called you, to talk about the top 12 at the box office.
Good. Okay, so here are the top 12 domestic weekend box office estimates for the 4th of July holiday weekend. Disney's Finding Dory continues to swim the world's box office oceans and tops the $500 million mark in the wake of a $76.3 million weekend. Here in the States, Disney's film brought in $41.9 million. Still doing very well.
Yeah.
and it's an adorable little film.
Yeah. It is adorable.
Yeah. Captain America is not the only summer box office behemoth from Disney, that's for sure.
Correct, Jim. You're right. Exactly. In second place goes to Warner Brothers, The Legend of Tarzan. That swung into 20 territories, including North America, this weekend, and came out with $56.9 million for its worldwide total.
Right.
Yeah, we were just saying we're really surprised by that showing. I thought it would be a distant 4th or 5th at the box office this weekend.
Yep, that had bomb written all over it.
I think it bought in the U.S. $38.1 million, and I think what really helped it is marketing. They really hit on the points. They hit on how funny the film is.
Well, funny
enough, it's very light. It doesn't take itself too seriously. Yeah. So I think that really helped, and I think people were looking who had seen Finding Dory and really didn't want to see the BFG. You know, they were able to take kids to go see this, and then it's content. So
there you go.
Yeah. And Samuel L. Jackson's wonderful in it. I think he was kind of a draw.
Right, Kate, exactly. I think so, too. I agree, Kate. Exactly.
And I was saying, I think Jungle Book helped Tarzan. Because people say, let's go see more wild animals in the jungle, because Jungle Book was so good. I do.
True, very true. So, at number 3 is The Purge Election Year. Universal's movie brought in pretty, this is really good, $3.9 million. People really wanted to go see movies this weekend, and they did, and drove.
Except for number 4.
Yes, and at number 4, The BFG, with $19.6 million. Variety said Steven Spielberg's $140 million children's fantasy film wasn't embraced by audiences, and it's his biggest flop since the film 1941, which I absolutely love.
Oh, yeah. You can't even mention those two movies in the same sentence.
Exactly. So that's why when I read Variety's article, I thought, oh, no, 1941 has to grow on you, and it's become such a cult,
It's Spielberg's. It's Spielberg's masterpiece.
can't quite go there.
Yes. More like a Mr. Piece.
People just didn't quite know what to make out of it. It's, I think we had talked previously about this, the other film,
Tintin.
Yeah, that came out a few years ago, and people didn't quite, in the States didn't quite know what to make out of it. And, I thought the trailers were, darling, and whoever cut those, genius. But translating Roald Dahl's book into a film kind of somehow got lost in there. So
really, I mean, the Terminal did more than this, huh? I'm surprised.
Yeah. And I really like the Terminal, but you know what? Spielberg's name alone is not a big draw anymore. It just isn't.
Right.
Let's see. Number five in its second weekend is Independence Day Resurgence from 20th Century Fox. There, the sequel brought in an additional $16.5 million. Variety reported that it topped the foreign box office, racking up $40.2 million from 64 overseas markets. Fox's Alien Invasion sequel sputtered in its domestic release, making $72.6 million over its first 10 days. By way of contrast, the first Independence Day racked in $135.4 million over the same period, and that was 20 years ago. And I keep saying, without Will Smith, this movie is just...
Well, even with... Like totally different. Now, Michelle, even with Will Smith, this is a weak script, you know?
Yeah, and that's true. Yes, it is. A lot of the little one-liners are just kind of, they fall flat.
Oh, my gosh. They leave a crater, they fall so flat.
yeah, that's true. At number six is Warner Brother Picture Central Intelligence, starring The Rock and comedian
Kevin Hart.
Kevin Hart. The film brought in $12.3 million, so it's still doing really well. And number seven is The Shallows. The Blake Lively Shrek movie brought in $9 million. And I saw that this weekend, and I absolutely loved it.
Oh, yeah.
I really did. It was perfect. I mean, you know, the July 4th holiday weekend. Jaws was released, you know.
I think it's better than Jaws.
Another good one, Tom. this guy's killing me, folks.
No, it's good. I totally agreed with everything in your review. Blake Lively's really good in it. She really holds the movie together. I very much enjoyed that.
I'm surprised it didn't do a little better. I'm surprised it got beat by Central Intelligence. Good grief.
Yeah. Central's been around, like, you know, for weeks, and, you know, Shallows is just a second weekend, right?
Maybe it's not as many screens.
But no, I just thought it was a really good. It was about time, you know, after Deep Blue Sea for another good shark movie, other than Sharknado, Sharknado 4 coming soon.
All right,
I can't wait. That's such a fun. That was fun to watch on social media.
No doubt.
So at number eight is Three Straight of Jones from STX Entertainment, the Matthew McConaughey movie. Still, you know, mixed reviews, brought in $4.1 million, and Kate reviewed that film for us.
Yes, I did. And actually, I liked it better than some people did. The mixed reviews were people seem to love it or hate it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's an interesting, you know, fact-based Civil War story.
I saw it Friday morning, and I liked it more than I thought I would. I liked the war stuff. I didn't really like Matthew McConaughey.
And it's funny that film was released during the summer, because you would think with him, the whole A-list star Academy Award, that they would have kind of put that towards the award season. But you never know. I mean, I'm sure they'll put it in with all the DVD screeners coming out at the end of the year.
You never know.
Yeah. So at number nine is The Conjuring 2, Warner Brothers film, brought in $3.9 million. The global haul now stands at $27.4 million. So it's still doing very well. And earlier this week, Warner Brothers also announced the production of Annabelle 2.
Oh, boy.
Oh, brother.
I hope it's better than Annabelle 1.
Has to be better than Annabelle 1.
In the number 10 spot is Now You See Me 2 from Lionsgate. The film brought in an additional $3 million. This film has generated $214.3 million globally since its opening last month. So it's doing very well overseas. This one and the original, both really fun fantasy-type films. In the 11th spot is Swiss Army Man. That stars Daniel Radcliffe and Paul Dano, and the film from A24 brought in $1.4 million.
Mm-hmm. Jim and I saw that last week.
Yeah.
We'll be reviewing it here in a minute.
Yeah.
Oh, good, yeah. Jim reviewed that. So rounding up the 12 is Archive of Trader from Roadside Attractions with $1
million. Good,
so
good, good.
12.
And then, good showing for that, yeah.
Next weekend we got, Pets and...
So opening Friday, July 8th, is Mike and Dave Need Wedding Day.
Oh, yeah, we've seen that, too.
That's the Zac Efron film. And also opening nationwide is The Secret Life of Pets from Universal, which I can't wait to see. The trailer just cracks me up.
It's very funny.
Also in limited release is The Innocent, Tickled, The Music of Strangers, and Wiener Dog.
I've seen Wiener Dog. I'm reviewing that.
Oh, good. Oh, excellent. What did you think of it?
Oh, it's very good. It's very good. It's one of Todd Solondz's best.
Yes. So there's your top 12 box office estimates for the holiday weekend.
All right. Well, thanks for calling.
You're welcome.
And have fun out there in Texas, and I hope you can call again next week.
All right, I will.
We probably won't have that many movies to review next week, so you can just go on and on and on next week. We got 8 movies to review this week, I don't know what we'll have next week.
Yeah, there's not a lot opening, which kind of bodes well for the movies in theaters.
All right.
Everybody gets a breather.
All right, talk to you next week.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye. All right, and that was Michelle McKeer calling in from Texas with the top 12. Now let's get down to reviewing these movies. Like I said, we got a lot of movies to review. And let's start with The Purge Election Year. I reviewed The Purge Election Year at WeAreMovieGeeks.com.
This July, have your voice be heard.
I purged.
I purged.
Show your support.
I purged because it's my civic duty.
For The Purge.
I purge because staying in is un-American.
And I gave it 3 out of 5 stars. I was really torn between 2.5 and 3, but I was just feeling a little generous. The Purge bought me a beer, so I gave it 3. This is the third in this goofy series where crime is not illegal for 12 hours once a year. So basically the premise is there's a presidential election coming up, and this woman, what was her name?
Charlie Roan
is running on an anti-purge platform. She wants to do away with the purge, which makes absolutely no sense. Well, why root for this woman? Because if she wins, there won't be any more purge sequels. So we've got her, and then you've got the pro-purge forces, who are just hateful individuals. And she decides that she is not going to spend the purge locked away in some fortified protective bunker, because that would make her seem weak and not someone of the people. So she decides that she's just going to stay at home. Well, what could possibly go wrong? Of course, the pro-purge forces infiltrate her home and kill all her bodyguards except Frank Grillo. What was his name? Leo Barnes. Yeah, Leo Barnes, played by Frank Grillo, who was actually in the second Purge movie.
Yeah.
But I don't think his name was Leo Barnes in the second Purge movie.
Oh, okay.
I don't think he had a name.
Oh, okay.
And he certainly wasn't in the Secret Service, who would be protecting a major party candidate, I would believe.
But we're to understand it's pretty much the same character.
Oh, it's the same. He's the same guy for all intents and purposes. I think they just brought him back for continuity. Anyways, they are heading out into the streets, and then there's a couple other characters that we meet out in the streets. There is a Michaele Williamson. Did I say his name right?
Michaele T. Williamson.
Yeah, he plays...
from Forrest Gump.
That's right. He plays a guy who has a shop.
Well, it's Joe's Deli.
Joe's Deli, that's right. He has a little shop in the city, and he gets a call just like 2 hours before the purge starts from his purge insurance agent, saying that his purge insurance premiums are going to go up thousands of dollars. Which the whole concept of purge insurance just kind of cracks me up.
Oh.
I mean, how could they pay out? Wouldn't insurance fraud not be illegal for those 12 hours? You just burn your own store down.
Well, it just would be, you know, people would sign up a month before, and then there would be thousands of dollars worth of damage. So it wouldn't do the insurance companies any good at all. But you know, calling him hours before it starts, I'm like, really? Are you kidding me?
But he's putting those darn one percenters, putting the little man down.
Oh, boy.
2 hours before the purge starts. And you've got another character who's driving around in this triage van.
Now was this concept in Anarchy? I must say I did not see the second film, but it has like a greenish blue cross on it, like almost like Red Cross but green cross.
They
weren't a force in the second film.
No, okay. She was not in the second film, I don't think.
There weren't these little vans running around helping folks. Okay.
In fact, that's one of the whole concepts of the purge is that, you know, the hospitals and the police can't help you no matter what happens. So I guess she's trying to override that.
Yeah.
By helping people who have been injured by the purge.
Yeah, because she thinks that the purge really targets people with low income and the homeless and all that sort of thing. So she and her friends are out in their little minivans helping folks without government help.
So. Yeah, so basically the purge election day follows these people around in the streets. And it's a lot like The Purge 2. It starts out with the sort of satirical and making fun of the current election and elections in general and politicians, and there's some decent satire there. But then after about, 15 minutes or so, it just devolves into running around the streets in the dark, being chased by these people who are participating in the purge, killing everybody and saying, what do these people do the other 364 and a half days of the year?
They just grit their teeth and wait for the purge.
I guess so.
It's kind of like the Warriors a little bit,
kind
of encountering all these different groups.
Yeah, and they're wearing like Halloween costumes and you know, one of them decorates their car in Christmas lights and goofy things like that.
But it's, what's interesting is they introduce in this film that the foreigners are actually making vacation plans around the Purge so they can fly here and kill Americans over 12 hours.
Wow.
And they interview them on TV. We can hardly wait.
Yeah. But it's just really just...
ISIS must love that.
It's just a series of chases and confrontations and shootouts. It's very gory. People's heads are blown off. And there's a scene where there's this giant guillotine set up in the this alley. It's just a throwaway. They, you know, they walk down this alley and this giant guillotine is lopping somebody's head off. And where do they store this guillotine, you know, the rest of the year? It's pretty silly stuff. It's pretty brutal, violent, humorless film. But if, like I say, if you liked Purge 2 and in Purge 1, you're going to like this film. There's really nothing wrong with it except that it's just kind of silly.
But they couldn't resist a little hint right before it goes black for the end credits that there would be another Purge.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, yeah. You know, they don't want to rule out any sequels at
all. Oh, yeah, of course. And it, obviously it made a lot of money. I think this does well with sort of the urban audiences, I believe.
Yeah. Costs very little to make, I'm sure. I think I think Rhode Island was substituted for Washington, D.C. in it. So.
All right. So, you know, if that sounds like something you would enjoy, you probably would. Now let's review The Legend of Tarzan.
You are Tarzan.
You may not like who you were. You may have enemies there. But you need to go home.
Which made a lot of money, which kind of defied everybody's expectations. Kate reviewed The Legend of Tarzan for WeAreMovieGeeks.com. How many stars did you give The Legend of Tarzan, Kate?
I gave it 3, although I went back and forth between 3 and 3.5.
Yeah.
You know, I thought it was fun, but, you know, there's some... It's problematic to reboot Tarzan in this era. I thought the film was... It was a little uneven, but it still was a lot of fun. And I like that they went back to an old-time Hollywood hero for summertime, a popcorn-munching adventure, and set it in the 19th century in colonial Africa and dealt with the colonial stuff. The film stars Alexander Skarsgård as Lord Greystoke or Tarzan, and it starts out with him as a lord in England, and he's left his Tarzan persona behind, and then this delegation comes to him with the mission to go to the Belgian Congo where something funny is going on. He's supposed to go on a goodwill tour to show that there's nothing really funny going on in the Belgian Congo. And one of the main characters in this delegation is played by Samuel L. Jackson. And I think he's a lot of the appeal of the film. For me, who plays an actual historic character.
Yeah, and he's a real guy. As
yeah.
I
yeah, but he was, not in the, he was not in the books or any of the other films.
No. This is not, it's not a film based on the books other than based on the character. And some parts of the book.
Yeah. The Opar figures into the Tarzan novels quite a bit. So that's in the film. As I understand, the villain in it is based on a real person, too, the Christoph Waltz character.
Yes.
Leon Rahm.
Yeah, Leon Rahm is played by
Christoph Waltz.
Christoph Waltz. And
kind of a Simon Legree type
performance.
He's not too subtle.
He actually has a mustache, but he doesn't twirl it, although they talk about his mustache. And I thought he did a great job as a villain.
Yeah, he was born to play that kind of role.
He could do that in his sleep, and in some scenes it seems like he was.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
There's nothing really new that he's brought to this character. As far as his villains go, I still think he'll never top Inglorious Bastards.
No doubt about that.
I agree. The most interesting character I thought in it was Samuel L. Jackson's character, who plays a kind of jaded fellow who he's now a medical doctor, but he served in the Civil War, and he's been a kind of mercenary, and he's there to find out if the Belgians have reinstated slavery. So
he's kind of the audience surrogate, too.
He also provides most of the humor with sort of his eye-popping response. I kind of like the fact that they dropped him into a new adventure without much of an origin story. There's a little origin and some brief flashback sequences. It's sort of weird that they start out with John Clayton, the Lord of Greystoke or Earl of Greystoke or wherever he is supposed to be, because I think a lot of people who aren't familiar with the Greystoke movie, for one thing, and some of the details about Tarzan are probably scratching their head saying, I thought Tarzan lived out in the jungle. Who's this guy living here in this big British mansion?
Yeah, it's interesting. In his outfit, you first seeing him in sipping tea, it's almost like a leather jacket that's too tight or a straight jacket, really, that he's just kind of confined into this, and he's wanting to burst out of there and get back on the vines. swinging around.
But they missed an opportunity, because you remember in Greystoke with Christopher Lambert, they had him in the mansion, but he was sort of acting like a caveman or an ape man within those sequences, which provided a lot of humor. They didn't do that with Alexander Skarsgård.
But what's funny is they have sort of an early version of a viral celebrity, because we actually see Tarzan on the cover of Punch magazine in the movie,
right.
And you know, like a little cartoon of him, you know, fighting a snake or something, and it says Lord Clayton getting lunch or something.
Well, I think if any audience members that are confused about who Lord Clayton or Lord Greystoke is, that's dealt with pretty quickly, because Samuel L. Jackson starts out by calling him Tarzan, which pisses him off. Once he gets back to Africa, once they persuade him to do this, he starts shedding his clothes and shedding his civilized manners, and we go straight into the Tarzan mode. And I thought Margot Robbie was really good as Jane. Sarsgaard, I thought, was pretty flat as Tarzan, but it left a lot of room for Samuel L. Jackson to both be the audience and modern sensibility and humor.
Well, yeah, I'd like to say it's a tough one. You know, the Tarzan's maybe the least interesting character in his own film. That's kind of tough. But yeah, I thought Margot Robbie in a lot of scenes, particularly where she has to have a dinner with Christoph Waltz's character, was kind of channeling Marion Ravenwood from Raiders of the Lost Ark, and she was kind of similar to that character there.
Yeah, and she was, you know, she was supposed to be kidnapped and in peril, and she didn't act very in peril. She was just kind of joking around and making wisecracks and smiling. She didn't seem particularly frightened of her.
She's a much different Jane. She's a lot more feminist. She's a lot more her own woman. In this version, she's somebody who also grew up in Africa, and she gets back there, and she's, you know, almost pace for pace behind Tarzan.
And
so I like that she's not the damsel in distress.
But I have some problems with the action scenes. Of course, they're very spaced, you know, through the film there. The pacing is a problem with that film. But it seems like they're cut so frenetically, you could barely tell what's going on, particularly in a fight dominance fight with one of the apes. I much prefer the wonderful Rick Baker apes from Greystoke to these kind of too smooth CGI motion capture apes. You know, they don't have a lot of weight to them.
Remember the first time you saw those Rick Baker apes for Greystoke? I mean, that was pretty startling.
Yeah, they're pretty amazing. And these are okay in it, but, you know.
Well, that's kind of what you expect. In today's movies. All right, let's move on, though, because we've still got six movies to review. So I like Tarzan. I would have given it, you know, three and a half, like Kate.
Probably do about three.
All right, so Tarzan, let's move on, though. Let's review Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates.
Mom and Dad, what's going on here?
Over the years at our family gathering, you two show up and you ruin it. I want you to bring a date to your sister's wedding. We don't want you showing up stag and riling each other up.
We don't rile each other up.
We never get riled up.
This stars Zac Efron, and who's the other dude?
Adam Devine. Dave and Mike Stengel, who are supposedly real guys also.
Yeah, and Aubrey Plaza, and what was the other guy?
Oh, that's Anna Kendrick is Alice, and Aubrey is Tatiana.
Yeah, so they play Mike and Dave, and Mike and Dave's sister is getting married in Hawaii, and they have a history of causing a big ruckus at all the family gatherings, so their father, played by Stephen Root, and who was their mom?
Stephanie Farisay.
Okay, they sit them down, and they say, you guys better get respectable dates, and you better behave yourselves, blah, blah, blah. So they take an ad out in Craigslist, and they need wedding dates, and whoever applies gets a free trip to Hawaii. So Anna Kendrick and Aubrey Plaza are these kind of stoner, drunk, manipulative young women who see this ad, and they sort of trick their way into a meeting of these two guys, and then, they get invited to Hawaii, and hilarity ensues, unless you actually see the movie. It's actually pretty stupid.
Well, it's stupid, but a lot of it's a good stupid. You know, I laughed pretty hard through most of it. Certainly more than Neighbors 2 or Zoolander 2 or any matter of comedy.
Both of those movies were funnier than
Central Intelligence.
This friggin' Divine guy is so obnoxious, and he's spending the whole movie just trying to steal every scene from Zac Efron. I feel sorry for Zac Efron. He was kind of in the background, like, why is this guy acting so obnoxious?
Well, Zac has the abs, so they steal every scene that he's in. But I think the main reason to see this is the two ladies, particularly Aubrey Plaza as Tatiana.
She's funny. She has
I think
best
she's a force
chops
of nature. She's
of
kind
the
of
four.
A yeah. She's kind of a cross between the Barbara Stanwyck character and this lady Eve, and a little bit of Bugs Bunny thrown in that she's always in control of the situation and she knows exactly how to twist these men around her fingers, particularly Adam Devine's character.
Yeah, I think Anna Kendrick didn't work quite as well. She just has such a wholesome persona to her. I think she has trouble pulling off this manipulative stoner druggy girl.
She's kind of got a backstory to her. Her character, she is, I guess the term is a hot mess. She was left at the altar a few years ago, so she's kind of still in a despair spiral from that. So the main reason that Tatiana wants to scam these guys out of this trip is to take her to Hawaii and get her out of her funk, get her back in the play mode. But it's there's some funny moments. I particularly have to single out a couple of the actors in it. Sugar Lynn Baird plays Mike and Dave's sister, Jeannie. And this is an actress that's absolutely fearless. She's game for anything. She's the butt of a lot of the jokes. You see her in the trailer taking a tire to the face.
Mm.
And she's a very good actress. Mostly has done voice work before. She's particularly great in a scene in which she gets the most unbelievable massage.
That scene was horrible.
Oh,
that scene went on and on and on and
funny.
On. That was ridiculous.
That was a very funny scene, particularly Kumail Nanjiani as Keanu. He's a very funny actor.
Yeah.
I've seen him in a lot of funny bits, and I thought this was a nice bit of slapstick, and that maybe lasts a minute and a half.
Yeah, this is a lame comedy. Let's move on. But Jim got some laughs out of Mike and Dave Need Wedding Day,
which is more than I can say for a lot of comedies out there.
I think it's one of the very worst movies I have suffered through so far this year. Let's move on from the worst movie of the year to one of the best movies of the year, and that movie of the year, in my opinion, is Todd Solondz's new film, Wiener Dog.
A dog is not human. It's an animal. Nature doesn't care about them. It's sad but true. We're a dog's only friend.
Hey, wiener dog. She looks like you.
Thanks.
I'm going to Ohio tomorrow. Want to come along?
What's in Ohio?
Crystal meth.
Todd Solondz is sort of an oddball filmmaker who's been around for 20 years making these movies about sort of sad sack losers. Started with Welcome to the Dollhouse back in 1995, which was the story of Don Wiener. And Don Wiener's back in this film, Wiener Dog. Wiener Dog, though, is really about this dachshund. And it's four separate stories where about this dachshund who goes from owner to owner, and it tells the owner's stories. And really, the dachshund isn't the central character. He is in the first story, but really the second, third, and fourth stories, he's not really not that particularly relevant to the plot. But I tell you what, there is some great writing in this film and some great acting, especially in this film. The first story in particular, he gets adopted by Julie Delpy. Who played her husband, do you remember?
Oh, that was a fellow who's a screenwriter, the fellow that wrote... Tracy Letts. He wrote August Osage County.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So.
Well, they adopt Wiener Dog and give him to their son who's recovering from cancer. But they are like the most inappropriate parents you could imagine. And Julie Delpy gives two or three or four just astonishing, just jaw-droppingly awkward speeches. There's a scene where she and her son are going to the vet to get the dog neutered, and he asks, what's the point of getting a dog neutered? And she gives a speech about when she was young, she had a puppy that was raped by the AIDS-infected neighborhood stray named Mohammed, and she had died in puppy birth and all this stuff. And this poor kid is just like, oh my God, what is going on here? But the kid gives the dog some granola bars, and the dog poops all over the house. So they take him to the vet, and that's where we meet Dawn Wiener, who's, like I say, was in Welcome to the Dollhouse.
Yeah.
Then she was played by Heather Mataranzo,
and
now she's played by Greta Gerwig, who looks and acts absolutely nothing like Heather Mataranzo, but that's okay. Todd Solondz has done this before, made sequels to his films, and cast people who look and act nothing like the original actors. So she teams up with Brandon, who was her tormentor in Welcome to the Dollhouse. But now they're friends, but Brandon's kind of a stoner, and they want to go to Ohio, and they visit with his brother and his wife, who both have Down syndrome. And they pick up a mariachi band. I think story number two, I don't know about you, but I think that was probably the least interesting of the four stories.
Yeah, the mariachi thing really doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that, I looked up, and the brother, Tommy, that they visit in Ohio, he's in the first film also, played by a different actor. There is a continuity with that first film.
Then you get to story three, which is absolutely brilliant performance by Danny DeVito. What was his character's name, do we know?
Oh, his name is Professor Dave Schmertz.
Yeah, and he teaches at a film school, and he apparently had a hit 20 years earlier with a screenplay he had written and has never really regained that glory, and he spends half the story on the phone with his agent, trying to get his agent to get somebody to read his script, but he's really cynical and bitter and sort of negative, and everybody at this college is having a problem with him because nobody wants to be around him. But there are some really hilarious scenes in that one as well. Remember when they're interviewing this film student and they say, why do you like films? What are some of your favorite films? And this film student says, I just like so many films. I don't know if I could just pick my favorite. Well, come on. What are some of your favorites? Oh, I don't know. I've just seen so many. I love them all. Okay, what's one movie you've seen in the past year? And this guy's like, I don't know. I just really love film so much. It's really, really funny stuff.
Reminds me of a political interview from a few years ago. Yes. But that's a good scene. But mostly that sequence is kind of a slam against the kids that are in the film programs at school. There's a scene later on in the cafeteria where they're like, but he likes Woody Allen films. They're just kind of putting down everybody.
Yeah, and that takes us to the fourth story, which also contains another brilliant performance. That's by Ellen Burstyn. Ellen Burstyn plays this old woman. Was she supposed to be blind?
No, I didn't get that. I didn't get it was Ellen Burstyn for about the first minute or two of the film when we just saw her in silent sequences going through her day. And then when she finally spoke, I said, that's Ellen Burstyn.
Yeah, now she has adopted the little dachshund, but she has named him Cancer. And she gets a visit from her sort of wayward granddaughter and her boyfriend who doesn't seem to be up to much good, but he's an artist and they need to borrow a bunch of money from her. And there's not a whole lot to the story, but it is really good, and Ellen Burstyn's really good in the film. But of course, all of Todd Solondz's films have these awkward confrontations, and there's a lot of sexual impropriety, and this Todd Solondz does not disappoint. I think this is probably his best film since Happiness, which is kind of his masterpiece.
I think I like Happiness a little bit more. It seemed with a couple of sequences weren't really that the payoff to the DeVito segment. I was kind of dissatisfied with, and that and the Ellen Burstyn sequence. I will say that Sosia Mamet as Zoe, I believe she's on the TV show Girl. She's very good. She's trying to be up and hip and wanting to ask for money and not seeming desperate. She's desperate not only for money, but to keep her boyfriend.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of a strong performance. Could have used a little bit less of the dog's digestive problems in the first segment. That's all I'll say.
One long tracking shot.
Oh, that is. You talk about the massage scene. This scene was long, buddy. You know, yeah, he wanted to get glorious close-ups of everything on the ground there. I really enjoyed it. I'm surprised you didn't mention this. The intermission song.
Oh, yeah.
That's very entertaining.
It's like something Tex Ritter might have sang or something. It's a really funny Western song. Wiener dog.
Wiener dog. Wiener dog.
Like that lightened my load after a couple of the down, tone of some of the sequences.
It's dark stuff. So look for my review of Wiener Dog this Thursday night at WeAreMovieGeeks.com. Still got a lot of movies to review. Kate, how about a 60-second review of Les Cowboys?
Okay, Les Cowboys, is a French film, and the family that's at the center of this they're Western reenactors. They go to like rendezvous. They have rodeos. They all dressed in Western wear. They do line dancing. They play country music. And at one of these events, the father's daughter, he's dancing to the Tennessee Waltz with his 16-year-old daughter, and later during the festival, she disappears. And they find out from her friends she's actually run off with her Muslim boyfriend. And they contact the parents of the boy, and they're also unhappy, and they're concerned that they've gone off to join an extremist group. Now, the story actually begins before 9/11, so as bad as that might sound, it's not as sinister at that point. The father goes on this search that kind of has some elements in common with John Ford's The Searchers, in which he's looking for years and years for his daughter, and he takes along her younger brother, who grows up in the course of the film and continues the search. And an interesting turning point to the film, where very much diverged from The Searchers, is when he goes to Afghanistan as an aid worker and meets this character played by John C. Reilly. And it's really a very interesting film. It has a lot of difficult subject matter. It's a great drama. It's very well acted. It doesn't go in directions you expect. And it's a heck of a film.
Okay,
it's
so Kate Plaza liked Lake Cowboys. Yeah, it's Plaza Frontenac. Steve Trotencheck reviewed Lake Cowboys for WeAreMovieGeeks.com, but he did not like it. He gave it 1.5 out of 5 stars. So I guess a split at the Geek site on Lake Cowboys. And opening to Frontenac this Friday is Tickled, which is a documentary. Anina Christensen was in here a couple months ago, and she had seen Tickled at the True False Film Festival and said it was the highlight of the festival for her. Jim saw it last week. What do you think of Tickled, Jim?
You know, I was like, okay, the military is going to use tickling as a torture tactic.
A dude in New Zealand, a reporter, like happened across this Facebook page.
Some sort of organized sport of tickling.
Oh, it's very compelling, very interesting premise. It's about an entertainment reporter for television in New Zealand by the name of David Farrar. He does little puff pieces, and he comes across on the internet these endurance tickle competition videos, and he thinks this would make an interesting little puff piece for television, and he starts investigating because he's a gay man. The response from Jane O'Brien Media, the company that produces them, is so weird to him that they don't want a deviant like him looking into their wholesome video entertainment. And of course this prods him to look into it even further, and he joins up with a fellow Kiwi by the name of Dylan Reeve, and they start investigating it, and they find out that Jane O'Brien is not who she says she is, and it's a tangled web of deceit and lies and assuming false identities and huge payoffs, college kids getting packages from FedEx full of thousands of dollars in cash to be in these videos. The people that leave the videos are attacked online by these people, and it's a really nice piece of investigative reporting. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those documentaries that starts off as kind of funny and then gets really dark and really mysterious.
And you'll be reviewing that for WeAreMovieGeeks.com?
I think I will, and I'll probably give it at least 4. I think it's very entertaining.
Sounds good. So Jim was tickled by Tickled.
Yeah.
A movie that neither Jim and I were tickled by. Swiss Army Man opened Friday and landed number 11 on the worldwide box office, or American box office, I should.
I needed you to help me get home. Okay, buddy?
Okay, buddy.
You're a miracle.
Say Swiss Army Man stars Paul Dano is a guy who's trapped on a desert island and he's about to kill himself, and right as he's hanging himself, he sees a guy washed up on the beach, and luckily the rope just happens to break right at that very moment, so he crawls over to this guy, and it's Daniel Radcliffe, and he's dead, unfortunately, but he's not dead. I don't know what he is. He farts a lot.
Yeah, boy, I tell you, does he have a lot of gas, this guy.
What did he eat, I wonder?
Yeah, damn.
So Daniel Radcliffe, did he have a name? Was any Manny?
Yeah, they named it Hank, is Paul Dano's character. Yeah. Names him Manny.
He has all these weird powers, and I guess that's why they call him the Swiss Army Man. He can shoot things out of his mouth. And
he's a water fountain, he's practically a fire hydrant, how the water's shooting out of his mouth in one scene, And it's very odd, and finally Manny starts talking to Hank, and they form a friendship. Manny he's supposed to be an innocent, and Hank is kind of introducing him to the ways of the world, and he's actually going into the jungle or into the forest and recreating like a interior of a bus and a movie theater. And is it pretentious.
It is, and precious.
It's
one joke or one note, one joke dragged out to a 100-minute long film.
In the first 30 minutes or so, it's pretty entertaining, but boy, it hits the skids there, and it just seems like it never ends.
Yeah.
And you might see Mary Elizabeth Winstead's name attached to this. She's really just seen through most of it, and you don't really get to encounter her till the very end of the film. So if you're going to the film for her, just be cautioned. This is like an art or a film school short that just goes on way too long.
Yeah, it's not very good, although some people like it, though. Some people are really digging this movie. So I think it's a little divisive.
Yeah, it's at 66 at Rotten Tomatoes. Yeah. I'm really surprised.
And some of the people that we saw it with were like, wow, that was so much fun. My wife, I took my wife, and she's like, oh, that was great, I love that. So
So if you're an adventurous film goer,
I guess. Well, I consider myself an adventurous film goer, but I really did not stand Swiss Army Man.
But like, it's an idea that just couldn't be sustained for an hour and a half.
Although not as bad as Mike and Dave Need Wedding.
Now, I disagree.
This Friday opens Secret Life of Pets. I saw Secret Life of Pets a couple weeks ago. It's really funny. It's by the studio that did the Despicable Me films. And it's plot-wise, it's pretty much a remake of Toy Story. It's about, what would our pets do once we leave the room? Well, they come alive, and they do the exact opposite of what you expect them to do.
They're not alive when you're there?
Now, you've got, and the main character is this...
I think he means they speak. And,
oh, I see.
Well, that's true. They
indulge in pop culture.
Yeah, and then there's this poodle you see in the trailer, and as soon as his owner leaves, he turns on, thrash, rock, heavy metal, and starts dancing around his apartment. But basically, the main character is this terrier named Max, voiced by Louis C.K., and he lives with, who's the gal? Ellie Kemper,
yes, yeah, from St. Louis.
That's right, and she
yes.
Plays his master, and they're really happy until one day she brings home another dog. His name, I can't think of his name, I think it was Rex or something like that. And he's this big, obnoxious dog. So the second dog sort of plays the Buzz Lightyear type character, because all of a sudden Max is jealous that he has to share his life with this other dog. But then they go out on a walk with a professional dog walker, and they get away and they get lost, and they go to underground where there's these pets led by a rabbit who had been abandoned by his magician. He's a magician's bunny, and he's voiced by Kevin Hart, and they hate humans. They want to kill humans, and that's all they talk about. It's pretty dark stuff, but it's also very, very funny. It's just really nonstop visual gags left and right, kind of like the Minions and Despicable Me movies, where there's not a whole lot of heart and sentiment to this film, but there's a lot of laughs. It's very funny. A lot of really funny characters. Dana Carvey plays this basset hound that has no use of his rear leg, so he's got these wheels, yet he's always a step ahead of all the other pets who kind of leave their apartment building to go search for Max. And then you've got Albert Brooks as this pet hawk. He tags along with this group too, but he just wants to eat everybody, and he spends the entire movie trying to resist the temptation to eat all the other characters. He's really, really funny. This is a great movie. In fact, I like this movie a lot more than Zootopia, which is the other animal movie that came out a couple of months ago. It's much, much funnier. And we'll talk about it more. Jim's going to see it this week. We'll talk about it again and do a little more in-depth review back and forth next Monday. So I think we've covered everything. Woohoo! Local stuff going on. Suspicion. That's an Alfred Hitchcock film starring Cary Grant and Joan Fontaine. Boy, that is playing this Saturday morning at the High Point.
From that moment on, my life was filled with fear. Not of Johnny. I loved him too much to really be afraid. But the fear of not knowing, the agony of waiting, of wondering how it would happen, of waking in the middle of the night, shaking with terror, and finding myself praying that whatever it was, it would be done quickly and with mercy.
10:30 a.m.
I'm really looking forward to seeing that on a big screen.
Oh, me too.
Oh boy.
Yeah, this is 10:30 a.m. It's $5. This is part of their classic film series that they do once a month. It's usually hosted by Harry Hamm, but Harry Hamm hasn't shown up the past 2 or 3 months. I introduced last month because Harry didn't make it. I don't know if I'm going to be introducing it this month or not, but I hope I am. I would be happy to.
Well, if you can't, let me know, because that was one of the first Hitchcock films I saw as a kid, and I became a Hitchcock fan immediately.
Yeah. And Joan Fontaine won the Oscar for that.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that was the year after she had starred in Hitchcock's Rebecca, which I think people thought she should have won the Oscar for, so it was kind of a consolation Oscar, from what I've read.
And I think she was the only actor to win an Oscar in a Hitchcock film, too.
Oh, okay.
That's right.
Yeah. All right, so that is Saturday morning. Also, Friday and Saturday at midnight, our buddies over at DestroyTheBrain.com do their monthly show, Late Night Grindhouse, and this week is Deep Red, Dario Argento's Deep Red from 1975, a really terrific Italian gory thriller with David Hemmings and Dario Nicolodi. Really my favorite Dario Argento movie, although apparently Andy has decided to show the 127-minute cut instead of the 90-minute cut, which I prefer. I saw the 90-minute cut probably half a dozen times before I saw the long version. And I think it flows a lot better, although it doesn't make as much sense. But that's okay. I do highly recommend seeing Deep Red this weekend at the Moolah, midnight. And tonight is my 16mm double feature night, and I'll be showing Day the Earth Stood Still and Richard Pryor Live at the Sunset Strip. This is over the way out club, and it starts at 8 o'clock, and it's free, but I set out a jar for the National Children's Cancer Society. And now I can announce next month's. This is like the best part of our podcast. I get to announce. I do this once a month. I announce next month's 16mm double feature night, and Here we go. Jim's doing the drum roll. Thank you, Jim. Okay, knock off. First, 8 o'clock from 1963, the giant monster bash of the century. Jim, what is it?
It's Godzilla versus Rodan.
You are incorrect, but you're close. You're halfway there. King Kong versus Godzilla.
Oh, that's from 63. Ooh.
Yeah, that was the first color Godzilla movie, and it's really funny, and it's a lot of fun, and I'm borrowing a 16mm print of that from my buddy Mike Doogie. And then after that, at 10 o'clock, we're going to show my print of St. Ives. St. Ives is a terrific detective thriller from 1978, starring Charles Bronson and Jacqueline Bisset and John Houseman and Maximilian Schell. A lot of good actors in that one. Mm-hmm. So that will be Tuesday, August 2nd at the Way Out Club. The Way Out Club is at 2525 Jefferson. So that's my big announcement. Also, I'll be hosting a screening this Thursday night, which is July 7th, of Vincent Price and The Last Man on Earth. It is Vincent Price Week in St. Louis. They're actually showing Edward Scissorhands Saturday afternoon at 1 o'clock at the library downtown.
Wow.
So Last Man on Earth. This is going to be fun. I'm going to do Vincent Price trivia, and I'll be giving away Vincent Price prizes. And this is a fundraiser for Helping Kids Together. All right, that's it for local things, I believe. Let's see. Let's talk about a few things in the news. We've lost an Oscar-winning director this weekend.
Yes.
Michael Cimino.
I looked him up. He's done did more films than I thought. I thought maybe he was just a bare handful, but maybe about seven or eight different feature films.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But, you know, over a career of 40 years, that's really not that much.
Yeah.
He, of course, won two Oscars for directing and producing The Deer Hunter in 1978, which is a masterpiece that still holds up. And then he did Heaven's Gate, and there's been books written about his behavior on the set of Heaven's Gate. That movie bankrupted United Artists. He would build these cities, you know, this whole street with these old houses, and then he didn't like the way the sun was shining on them, so we'd have people tear them down and move them, you know, across the street and have them built there. It's just all kinds of crazy stuff like that. And
it's a famous film about excess, but I think I'm one of the few people that actually liked the film.
I've never seen
it's very long
ago.
And slow, but it has there's a whole lot of good things about it.
I think it's a superb film. And then he had trouble getting work. He did, what was the one with Mickey Rourke?
The Year of the Dragon?
Year of the Dragon, that was good. The Sicilian with Christopher Lambert, we were just talking about.
Desperate Hours, a remake of that.
Yeah, that's right. So, but he did a few other films, but then his career really kind of petered out. He was sort of unofficially blacklisted because of what he did with Heaven's Gate, and his name became kind of synonymous with excess. Mm-hmm. But he died, so RIP, died at age 77 over the weekend. And there was another death. Jim, talk about Noel Neal.
Oh, Noel Neal. Of course, everyone knows her really as the first woman to portray Lois Lane in a live-action version on the screen in the 1948 serial Superman opposite Kirk Allen. But then she achieved superstardom when she took that character to television alongside George Reeves in The Adventures of Superman, which she did from 1953 to about 1958. She had a heck of a film career starting in 1940 with Mad Youth. She was the love interest in a couple of the Henry Aldridge films based on the radio character. And later on, well, she had unbilled cameos in An American in Paris and Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. And, of course, in her later years, she had cameos in the Superman films. In Superman the Movie from 1978, she plays Lois Lane's mother, who's on a train with young Lois and her husband, who's played by Kirk Allen in that scene. And then she was also in the opening sequences of Superman Returns as the elderly millionaire that Lex Luthor has swindled. Mm-hmm. So she was 95. I got to meet her in 2007 at the Metropolis Superman Festival. She was a mainstay there, so much so that there is a statue of her as Lois Lane in the town square area. So she was 95, a long career, and you know, thanks for being a pesky reporter at the Daily Planet, Noel Neal.
So what was she like when you met her?
Oh, well, she really wasn't saying much. Mm-hmm. She posed for a picture with me, which was nice. And she was mostly signing copies of a book about her her life and career. But, it was great to finally meet somebody from, one of my favorite TV shows as a kid growing up.
So. All right. So R.I.P. Noel Neal, who died at the ripe old age of 95. But she's not the oldest actress in town. No. Oh, Olivia de Havilland turned the big 100 a couple of days ago. Wow,
yeah,
good for her.
Friday.
When we just talked about Joan Fontaine being in Suspicion, they were sisters. Was Olivia older?
Yes, she was the older sister.
Yes, yes.
But she outlived her younger sister.
And I guess she's probably the only living major cast member from Gone Gone with the Wind.
Yeah. I believe she is.
Yeah. So, 100 years old this past Friday. Born in Tokyo, Japan, I saw that.
Yeah, born in Tokyo to British parents.
She doesn't look Japanese.
Well, British parents.
Yes. Very, very British. So, should I tell you my favorite Olivia de Havilland film?
Please.
Last week, we mentioned Mel Brooks, and my favorite film of all time is Young Frankenstein. My second favorite
film. Me too.
Second favorite film of all time is Adventures of Robin Hood.
There you go. Errol Flynn.
That's Bowie. Pure Alan perfection. Hale. Uh-huh. Perfect film. So.
Yeah. Who's she playing that? Maid Marian?
She is Maid Marian. She's the ultimate Maid Marian. She's kind of linked on screen with Errol Flynn for about 6 or 7 different movies, and they're just terrific entertainments.
All right. What's your favorite Olivia
well,
to have?
Well, okay, I was kind of torn between three because she almost steals the show as Melanie in Gone with the Wind.
Yeah.
So that's a wonderful performance, although, you know, it's not her film. She made a terrific film debut as Hermia in Midsummer Night's Dream, probably the best film version of that with a spectacular cast, including Mickey Rooney and James Cagney. But I would say is my favorite, I'm going to pick another swashbuckler, Captain Blood, also with Errol Flynn.
Oh, she's
because
dazzling.
She's just wonderful
she's,
in that.
She's just
the two of them together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Do you
have
a favorite, Tom?
I do have a favorite Olivia de Havilland movie, as a matter of fact. Olivia joined the Hag Horror Gang after the success of Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. A lot of actresses of a certain age that made a whole string of knockoffs. There was What's the Matter with Helen, with who was in that, Shelley Winters. And Die My Darling with Tallulah Bankhead. And Olivia de Havilland joined that gang with Hush Hush Sweet Charlotte, where she teamed up with Bette Davis. And it was sort of a quasi-sequel or follow-up, at least, to Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. It's pretty good, but that's not the movie I'm picking. I'm picking another movie that sort of falls into that genre, and that would be a movie I saw when I was like 6 years old that just had an indelible impact on me, and that is called Lady in a Cage.
Oh, yeah.
Lady in a Cage is a remarkable movie, and it's aged really well. I watched it not too long ago. It's about she plays a woman who's recovering from a broken hip, and she has one of these little elevators that takes her up and down the second floor of her house, and she's halfway up and the electricity gets shut off in her house, so she's sort of trapped between floors right at the same time that these three thugs played by Jennifer Billingsley, who was you'll remember from White Lightning, and Rafael Campos, who you may remember from Blackboard Jungle, and in his big screen debut, James Caan. So these three guys come in and they just mentally torture this poor woman. She escapes. There's a kind of a brutal scene where she escapes and James Caan just tackles her in the yard and just drags her back into the house. It's kind of a brutal and weird movie, and it's all about how her neighborhood is really falling apart, and there's just bums and winos and all sorts of crime all around. It really has a lot more to say than just this kind of weird thriller. But I saw that movie when I was a kid, and I've never forgotten it. I've always had a soft spot for Lady in a Cage.
Well, happy 100.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Kirk Douglas turns 100 in December.
Oh,
so we'll be talking about our favorite Kirk Douglas movie.
Oh, that'll be a tough one.
Unless he dies before then we'll have to talk about our favorite Kirk Douglas movies earlier. But let's hope he doesn't.
He's going to make it.
Let's hope not.
Yeah,
you
know, Loden Oilens, what, 101, 102?
Who's that? Sorry.
Lloyd Nolan?
Oh, he's still around. Oh, my goodness. Oh, yeah.
I'm just trying to think of who's still around. And then,
Doris Day is still around.
Yeah, Doris Day. She's in her 90s. Professor Irwin Corey is 104. All right. Well, we've got to wrap this up. Doggone it.
We got Tarzan movies?
Well, no? I don't know if we really have time. Okay. Around the table, what's your favorite Tarzan movie, Jim?
Tarzan and the Valley of Gold.
Is that with Gordon Scott?
No, that's with Mike Henry.
Oh, Mike Henry.
66.
Okay. I don't know if I've seen that one.
Oh, yeah.
Mike Henry from Smokey and the Bandit. What's yours?
Okay, I might get the title wrong because I'm not the biggest Tarzan fan, but I'd say Tarzan Finds a Mate. Tarzan and His Mate.
And the
classic Johnny Weissmuller
one. Yeah,
ones.
Tarzan and His Mate.
Yeah.
And that is mine as well. So we love Tarzan, but we've got to wrap this up. But we got through a lot of stuff. We got a lot of information done in our podcast today, so good for us. Bravo. Next week, we'll be back. We're going to do a more in-depth review of Secret Life of Pets. I don't know what else going to review next week, but we'll talk about movies because that's what we do. But for now, I'm Tom Stockman,
Jim Batts,
Kate Marquis.
Kate, thanks a lot for joining us. You were
great.
Thank
you.
And listen again next week.
Black leather, rock. Black leather,
ta ta ta.
Black leather.
Oh, nutty state. Hello, darling.
Hey. Black leather, rock. Black leather, ta ta ta. Black leather, hip. I got that feeling, black leather rock.